We're falling to Earth. Al Warden is the astronaut who is very well respected. He was living the American dream at a time when very few people could say that they were going to the moon, and it was what everybody wanted to do, and he was doing it. But coming back to Earth after the ticker tape parades and all of the accolades and TV shows, Al Warden was essentially fired. And for the first time ever, he's telling the story in Falling to Earth, and we'll talk to him about it next. And what it was like to be in space, and all that that happened when he was there, what he saw on his very unique firsts that he was able to do as an astronaut next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. By the way, if you wanted the information on how to help out the families involved, both the SEALs and for the Army families that were involved in that shootdown of the Chinook that we talked about last hour, that information is online at coasttocoastam.com. So is the connection for Al Warden falling to Earth. Good evening, Mr. Warden, or Commander Warden, or what do we call you, actually?
Good evening, Ian. Just Al. We'll do fine.
What was your highest rank before you left?
I was a lieutenant colonel when I retired.
Lieutenant colonel. That's pretty darn good. You have such an interesting story. Your book came fairly late in the week, so I had to do what I don't like to do, which is to start a book at the end and sort of read backwards. So I know where we're going to go, but I don't always know where we're going to start.
Yeah. I guess most of the good stuff is at the end of the book anyway. So
I don't know about that.
Start.
No, see, and I love autobiography, and I think this is fascinating. And your story, I mean, already, I mean, you're living the dream life. If in any way you could have been qualified even for one trip to the moon. But let's talk a little bit about when did you get into NASA? How did you get qualified? How, I mean, obviously, you're unlike somebody like me, you didn't grow up at a time when people were actually talking about getting to the moon. It must have been a very cool idea when suddenly they were really seriously looking for astronauts.
Well, I have to tell you, Ian, that was never part of my thinking when I was a kid. I grew up on a farm in Michigan. And as a matter of fact, I basically ran the farm myself from the time I was 12 until I went off to college. And one of the things I decided in during those years was that the last place I wanted to live the rest of my life was on a farm. I wanted to get as far away from it as I could. So I eventually got an appointment to West Point, and I went there and graduated, went into the Air Force. And that kind of set me on a path. If you're going to be in the Air Force, you're going to be a pilot. Professionally, the next step is to be a test pilot. And to do that, I went back to college, got a couple of master's degrees, and then went to a test pilot school in England. That kind of set me up. As a matter of fact, while I was in England and I was about ready to graduate from the test pilot school, the U.S. test pilot class came over on a visit. And the commandant back in those days was a fellow by the name of Chuck Yeager. And as soon as he got off the airplane, he came over to me and said, "Hey, I need you back at the test pilot school at Edwards to teach." So they cut my tour in England short, and I came back and taught. Well, by then, I had just about everything that, you know, that was needed to be an astronaut. And I never really thought about going into the program. But lo and behold, a year after I got back, NASA had an application process, and I applied and got in. So it wasn't that I was that I lived my life thinking that that's going to go into space. It was that I got all the requirements filled because it was my professional career path. And what I found was once you get all those things under your belt, then other doors open, and the NASA door opened for me, and I became an astronaut.
Well, that's just too cool. And what's interesting about that is it really kind of sounds a little more matter of fact, and not quite like the, you know, Willy Wonka, I got a magic ticket, you know, like discovering the golden wrapper inside a candy bar. I mean, you're working toward it, and you qualified, and boom, you were there.
Well, you know what, Ian, that's what I tell kids when when they're going to school. You know, I still believe that the space program is the greatest motivator that our young people have had in this country for many, many years. And I tell kids, pick your career path and do the best you can in it. And if you do well, when you get to the end of your academic life, then you'll find that there may be some doors open in areas that you never even considered. But if you do well in the path that you've chosen, those doors could open to you. And that's kind of what happened to me.
So what year was it then?
I went in, I arrived in Houston in April of 1966. I was part of a group of 19 that were selected that year for the Apollo program. We started out with the basic requirements. There were like 830, I think, that had applied that were all met the basic requirements, and they ended up picking 19 of us.
So who was in your class? If you know, of the people that we come to know later on,
Of the 19, well, there was Jim Irwin, of course, who flew with me on the flight, was in that group. Charlie Duke, who was a lunar module pilot on 16, Stu Roosa and Ed Mitchell on Apollo 14, Fred Hayes and Jack Swigert on Apollo 13. We're all in my group, and some of them stayed on and became shuttle pilots, like Fred Hayes, and Ken Mattingly was on Apollo 16. He was in the group too.
Right.
So quite a few of the guys in my group were able to make a flight, and kind of sad that those who didn't make a flight and make a lunar flight had to wait for something like 10 years before the shuttle was ready to fly.
But still,
so
in a way,
I was fortunate to get in when I did.
Yeah, and then get up into space, and so, but you had kind of this this role, that this sort of the unsung role of the CMP, right? The command module pilot.
Right. Right.
Okay. So well, talk about, was that good news or bad news that you seemed to make a great command?
Well, see, I thought it was good news back then. You have to understand where you stand professionally in the crew back in those days. And of course, you know, that's old history now, but back then, the command module pilot, got most of the flying time, on the flight. I flew everybody out to the moon, stayed in lunar orbit by myself, making a number of trajectory changes while I was there. And then I flew everybody back home. Dave Scott, the commander, his responsibility basically was, control of the spacecraft during launch, and then he flew the lunar module down to the surface and back up when they got there. And Jim Irwin is the lunar module pilot, and this is true of all lunar module pilots. He didn't get to fly anything. He was kind of the systems engineer. If you understand how the flights were organized, there's a commander or a command module pilot and a lunar module pilot. Well, the lunar module pilot watched all the systems on the way to the moon and back. And then he was kind of like the second guy in the lunar module as a co-pilot on the lunar landing and the lunar ascent. And of course, the commander flew the thing down to the moon. So that's kind of how it was organized. And back in those days, it was kind of nice. It was a good sign to be a command module pilot, because the next step would be a commander. Lunar module pilots, not having flown either one, or, you know, being responsible for flying either one of the spacecraft, weren't likely to become a commander right away, because they hadn't flown anything. They'd have to learn two systems, whereas a command module pilot only has to go on and learn the lunar module. So,
it was a
quicker step to being a command to being a commander, is what I'm trying to say.
Right. No, which I totally get. So as a CMP, as a command module pilot, that also came with its own kind of restrictions, though, too. Right. I mean, there were certain things you weren't going to be able to do.
Oh yeah. Well, you mean like land on the moon?
Yeah. Right.
Oh, sure.
So you right. So, but did you know that up front? Did you know if you go down this route, you'll never be able to land on the moon?
Well, on that flight, yes. Okay. But what I was hoping at the time was, we still had a few flights to go, and I was hoping that maybe I'd become a commander on one of the later flights. But then, if you recall, NASA canceled 18, 19, and 20, so that opportunity went away. But I didn't know that at the time we were making our flight. So
sure.
I was still hopeful that maybe there was a commander slot for me in the future.
So again, we're talking with Al Warden, Falling to Earth, new book out, and we tell your story from your own perspective for the first time completely, and we'll get into many more details. Let me digress a little bit then back to your personal life, because
sure.
You know, we kind of picture a lot of the astronauts or at least I do, maybe, and maybe there's part of my generation that does, from the lens of I Dream of Jeannie. And, right? I mean, we're the young bachelor NASA astronauts. And that was pretty much your life, minus the Jeannie part, wasn't it?
Well, in many respects it was. But I think the point that a lot of people don't understand is the hard work that goes into getting ready for a flight. We trained for 3 years for our flight. A year and a half as a backup crew on Apollo 12, which allowed us to learn all the systems and how to fly it and, you know, how to get to the moon and back. And then we spent another year and a half training for our flight in particular. In that year and a half, we really focused on all the science that we're going to do on a flight. So it's long. I spent 3 years, and I figured out one time that my average work week was 70 hours. And I took like a 10-day break in the middle of that 3 years. So that's the other side of what we did back then. You know, it's a little bit like a football team. We see them on television on Saturday, and they're all dressed in their best uniforms, and they go out there and they play, and it's a big thing. And a lot of people don't realize that they have worked really hard training and learning their game all week long to get ready for that Saturday. And that's a part of it that nobody sees. And I think we were kind of led that way, too. I think, you know, it's a big rah-rah thing. It's great to be recognized and to make a flight like that when you got the whole world watching you. But at the same time, understanding that there's an awful lot of hard work that goes behind that.
Well, I know that took a toll on your marriage, right?
Yes, it did. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm in particular, I'm drawing your attention to a photo on page 112 of you and your very modly dressed daughters in what looks distinctly like...
That was in my apartment in Houston, yeah.
Okay, so my I Dream of Jeannie image, you were totally living that, because I'm looking at the shag carpeted stairs winding to your bedroom upstairs and all of the what looks like a very happening place to be in Houston leading up to your flight.
My apartment was kind of a gathering place for everybody. Lots of people came over and we had, you know, good times there. The girls just lived across the street. I was divorced at the time when that picture was taken. And the girls just lived across the street, and they were with me a lot. I had kind of a mod apartment. That gave me a little bit of a reputation around town. But I was there so seldom that it really didn't have much impact on me. I could have been living anywhere. And again, it's all the work. I mean, I was gone from Sunday to Friday almost every week, going somewhere to train or find, you know, learn something new. And so I was very seldom at the apartment.
Your story then, though, it obviously for, you know, you were focused, you were trained, you were in the very top of the pyramid there of the in any branch of the military, in any government service, and in celebrity as you were getting ready for your flight. Talk about the first time you went up into space, Al.
Well, Apollo 15 was my sole flight into space.
Right.
I had not had the opportunity to go before. Actually, timing has everything to do with all of that, and I happened to be in the right place at the right time. And do a good enough job that I was selected for Apollo 15. And it turned out, because of a number of things, that there was no flight available to me after that. And part of that was some trouble that we got into after the flight.
Which we'll get into coming up. But, I mean, when you were getting up to that first day, this is what your life has been leading up to. I mean, this is it. This is what it was all for.
What
was that like?
We went into quarantine 3 weeks before the flight to make sure that we were healthy on launch day. So we were pretty isolated from the world, and we just really concentrated on all the final little details of the training that we had to do leading up to the flight. And we were so engrossed in the training and going over flight plans and procedures and all the things we have to do on a flight that we really never gave much thought to, you know, what it would be like to actually make the launch. Now, Dave Scott had been in space before. He had flown twice, once on Gemini 8 with Neil Armstrong, and then again on Apollo 9. So he was kind of an old salt and kind of knew what was going on and all that. And he kind of counseled Jim Irwin and I on all that. And I don't recall us ever. I went to sleep the night before the launch and slept very peacefully. And, to wait until Deke Slayton came along and woke us up for the launch in the morning. I don't recall ever being really nervous or tense or excited about the launch because we had done it like 500 times in simulation, and it was just like doing simulation all over again.
So well trained were you and so well prepared that it just was it was as though you had already done it. So no right. Particular moment of like, oh, my God, this is finally happening.
I did have that feeling in the elevator going up the side of the launch vehicle because when we launched, we were some 350 feet above the engines on that thing.
How about that?
Got off at the 35th floor and looked over the handrail and saw the ground 500 feet down and realized at that point that, hey, this is the day. We're going to go.
Is that the first time you ever took that ride up to that height?
Yeah. Yes.
Wow.
We've been up there. We had been up there getting the spacecraft and the launch vehicle ready for launch.
Okay. All right.
We'd gone through some procedures out there on the launch pad prior to the launch, but that morning was it, and it was pretty obvious. They fueled the spacecraft or the launch vehicle the night before, and part of the fuel was liquid oxygen, and part of it was liquid hydrogen. Which is very, intensely cold. You're talking a couple hundred degrees below zero. And what happened over the night, of course, in Florida, particularly in July, it's pretty humid. And what happened overnight was that ice formed on the outside of the launch vehicle. I would say there was at least an inch of ice on the outside skin of the launch vehicle. Mm. And as we went up in the elevator, I could see sections of that ice coming loose and falling to the ground. And that's the first time I had seen that. And that was kind of, that's the last thing. I mean, this thing is all fueled up and ready to go, and this is it.
Right. That'll get your attention when you're watching that from 350 feet up in the air or whatever.
Yeah, you say, oh, yeah, and then you think, gee, I wonder what would happen if I decided that I didn't want to go. Well,
that's exactly the thought I'd be having, is what would happen if I just said, I'm not ready. I know.
It's a little too late to make that decision then.
in a way, if you had gotten trouble for that, I might better understand it than what you end up getting in trouble for later on. But again, we'll get to that coming up with Al Warden. Sure. But let me see, when you say you're getting up there and you've been quarantined, I want to ask you a question I couldn't help but think about earlier. Just on some odd chance that while you're going up into space, or because of the pressure or for whatever circumstances, is there any contingency for if an astronaut dies leaving the Earth's atmosphere?
Mm-hmm.
There is?
Well,
did they talk about that?
There's no contingency, but it would sure change the flight plan.
Yeah. Well, would they just bring it back? Would you just abort the flight?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. If somebody had a problem during launch or in Earth orbit or even on the way to the moon, your flight plan would change completely. You would not land on the moon. If you're too far out to just make a direct return, you'd go around the moon and come back like Apollo 13 did.
Right.
If it was during the launch and you had that kind of a problem, you'd probably abort the launch and just come back down in the ocean on parachutes. But we never really talked about that very much. And, it's kind of interesting you asked that question because a lot of people think we took poison pills in case we had a problem and we knew we weren't going to get back and, we could end it all peacefully. And that's not true. We never did.
They never gave them to you? You didn't have any?
No. We didn't carry anything like that.
So you would have. You would have just had to have drifted out into space forever until Well, we learned so much. Al Warden, thank you for hanging on. We've got more to get to. Falling to Earth is the new book. You can link up to it at coasttocoastam.com. And I want to talk a little bit about Apollo 13, what that was like to live through before we get back to Al's flight, Apollo 15, and what he did there, and then what happened once he came back, coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Falling to Earth, Al Warden tells his story of Apollo 15 and what happened afterward. Finally, we'll get to all of the details on that coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So, Al Warden, talking about his memories of NASA and beyond in Falling to Earth, let me ask you about where were you when Apollo 13 was breaking down? The news started to filter back that, you know, Houston, we have a problem.
Ian, I was in Houston at the time. I was home and watching the TV. And I remember watching, I think I was watching ABC at the time when the oxygen tank exploded. And it was sort of like life or death. The guys only have like 2 hours to live or something like that. And I got in my car and hot-footed over to Mission Control. And several of us got busy. The engineers in Mission Control, of course, were looking at all the systems to see what they could do. And a number of us, mostly in my group, Ken Mattingly, Stu Russa, Joe Engel, myself, we kind of got to the simulator and started working procedures to allow the crew to shift their life support system from the command module into the lunar module, which required them to put some stuff together with duct tape.
Sure.
So we were pretty busy doing that, and we were busy for a couple of days working out all those procedures to help them get back. But I was in Houston at the time, and I was just across the street from the center, so it only took me about 15 minutes to get over there.
You know, I love that part of the movie, Apollo 13. I've seen it many times, but I haven't seen it recently. So are you one of the guys then that Ken Mattingly takes into the simulator in the movie?
Yeah, I would be one of those guys that went in the simulator to work out the procedures. I think Stu Russa actually probably put it a little more time than I did, but it was kind of a group solution. A bunch of us were working on it at the time.
Sure. And so when they would say, run it again, we got to run it again, that would have been you running it again inside that the simulator?
Yeah. That was quite an exciting time, as a matter of fact. And of course, the failure's no option comment came out of all of that, which Gene Kranz admits he didn't say. Somebody in one of the engineers in the Mission Control room said that first, and then Gene picked it up. And of course, that's been his kind of rallying cry since then.
Sure. Funny.
That was kind of the attitude, is that, hey, guys, we got those three guys in trouble up there, and we are not going to lose them. We'll do whatever it takes to get them back. And thankfully, that happened.
Was there a superstition around Apollo 13 before it went up?
If there was, I never heard it.
Okay.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are superstitious about the number 13.
Yeah, I'm not, but I'm just curious whether there was.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting. I think just purely coincidental that it happened to be Apollo 13 that had that problem. You know, it is kind of interesting, though, that what happened to be 13 that had the problem.
Sure. And Gene Kranz, you know, we see him portrayed in different movies and in documentaries. And
right.
he really seemed like kind of a one-of-a-kind kind of guy.
A one-of-a-kind kind of guy. Very, very straightforward, very tough. Really made everybody focus on what had to be done. I think Gene Kranz was the right guy at the right time, at the right place, to get it all done.
Yeah. You know,
it's pretty phenomenal.
It has sort of this, at least in the way he's portrayed, there's sort of this mix of rocket scientist and, Marine drill sergeant aspect is there truth to that?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, of course. He was a pilot. In fact, he's still flying his airplane around, I think.
That's great.
As I recall, the last I heard, he had built his own airplane. he's got a couple of them, I think, and he's been flying it around. Yeah, he's a pilot, and he's a tough guy, but he's very, very logical in his thinking and very clear-cut when it comes to a problem. You know, you take step one, step two, step three, and you work your way through the problem, and you get the problem solved. There's no shotgun approach to it. It's a rifle shot, and you take care of the first problem, and then you go to the second one, and on like that. And I think that Gene Kranz's leadership in mission control during that period was a big factor in saving the crew.
That Ken Mattingly image too. I mean, a couple of the guys in the movie Apollo 13. I know this will be the last time I go to that well, but I was sort of curious about it because I really liked that movie quite a bit, and I like Ron Howard and Tom Hanks, and there was that again that image of sort of the Playboy astronaut, the swinging astronauts. Is that just all just for fun, or were you all kind of a hard drinking, hard partying crowd? Without naming names,
well,
you don't have to name.
I wouldn't come right out and say they're hard drinking, hard partying guys and all that. But you have to understand, they're all pretty much individuals. They didn't get into the space program by being milquetoast. They didn't get into the space program by not doing more than their job required to get there. So these are all pretty aggressive guys. They're pretty pretty individualistic. They're all striving to make a flight and do a good job on the flight. So, yeah, I think come with that territory comes an image of, hey, these guys are just hard chargers and, you know, they're going to do everything in and out of the program. And, that's true of some of the guys. But most of the guys they just worked hard and did their job and did it the best way they could. And there wasn't a lot of the other stuff.
It doesn't sound like there's a lot of time or energy for it, the way you describe it. But
I think mostly energy.
Yeah.
I don't know how you can work for 10 hours a day and then still have energy left over to do anything else.
But it's that clash of type A personalities that is part of your story, too, when we get into
That's
it
right.
here. So let's talk a little bit about your relationship with the other crew members of Apollo 15 before you went up.
We were a very business-like, professional crew. Jim Irwin was my office mate at the time, and Jim and I were really very, very close friends. Dave, as a commander, he projected a very authoritarian air. He was very detail-oriented. He took notes on everything. He made sure that all the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted. Very, very thorough, detailed guy, also very authoritarian. So there wasn't a lot of camaraderie in the crew, you know, as such. We were the backup crew for Apollo 12. That was Pete Conrad, Dick Gordon, and Al Bean. They were all Navy pilots. And if you saw one of them, you saw all three because they were just like brothers. Everything they did together. We weren't that way. I kind of went my own way as a command module pilot, and Dave and Jim kind of trained on the lunar module. And so we did a lot of our training in separate ways, and we weren't always, you know, we didn't run around together. It was a whole different thing. But because of that, I think we ended up as a better crew to go to the moon. Because we had this little professional thing going on between us that you better do everything or somebody's going to say something to you.
Right.
And, you know, there's no covering up for anybody. So we did everything that we're supposed to do on the flight. In fact, we did more than we were supposed to do. And that's why a lot of people, particularly the scientists, will tell you that Apollo 15 was the most scientific flight in the program, probably the most successful flight in the program.
But define success then when you say most successful flight. That's very interesting, and I know you're right about that a little bit because I read that part. It's great.
Yeah, well, I think it's because months before the flight, leading up to a year or even a year and a half leading up to the flight, we started loading the flight plan with all the science that we're going to do on the flight. There was a kind of a nominal amount of science to do on a flight, depending on the timeline and whether you had the time to do something. We took a little different approach. We put everything that anybody asked us to do in our flight plan. And let's say 100% would be the normal amount of science to do on a flight. We loaded our flight plan with like 125%, and with the thinking that it would be easier to take something out of the flight plan than it would be to add it in flight. Well, we ended up doing all of it. And I think that kind of surprised everybody. And that's why, you know, there's so much said about the success of Apollo 15.
This was the ninth overall mission in the Apollo space program.
Right.
You were the fourth to go to the moon
mm-hmm.
successfully.
We were the fourth landing crew on the moon. Yeah.
So what was left when they were, you know, you're ramping up to that and you've got other missions, obviously, while after you've already been assigned your crew and you're already training, what was left for NASA to get from the moon or for you to do on the moon before you left?
One of the things, you know, the makeup of the moon had always been a mystery. We wanted to know what caused the features on the moon. We wanted to know what the inside of the moon looked like. We wanted to know what the chemical composition of the moon was. Our flight went in a pretty different direction from the flights before us. All the flights from 11, 12, and 14 landed fairly close to the lunar equator because we had a lot of information about that part of the moon with unmanned flyers, lunar orbiters, and that kind of thing. Our flight landed 28 degrees north of the lunar equator because we needed to get a wider set of rock samples from other parts of the moon. So we were in quite a different trajectory than anybody before us. We had six flights that landed on the moon in various spots. The moon is still 99% unexplored. So there may be some things there that we don't know about. But I think with the six flights that have been there, we're beginning to get a pretty good picture of the moon and what caused it. And what's there now and what the inside of the moon is. You know, every single flight that went there left a seismograph on the lunar surface. And by getting the information from those sites, let's say a meteor should hit the moon and those seismographs pick that up, then from that data that they get back from all six of those seismographs, they begin to build up a picture of the inside of the moon. So there are a lot of things we need to know. Recently, they're talking about there might be some water at the South Pole. That would be a good place to go visit.
Right.
But outside of that, the moon's probably not a prime target.
So your commander, David Scott, and your lunar module pilot, James Irwin, go down to the moon with that cool rover thing.
Right.
That was the first time they used the lunar rover?
That's right. In fact, we had the lunar rover loaded into the lunar module, and we had a scientific instrument module in our service module that stayed in orbit. Those things added significantly to our weight, and in fact, we ended up having the heaviest flight in the program because of that extra equipment that we carried. But in the sim bay, which was in the service module, we had two large cameras. One was a high-resolution camera. Kind of an interesting story about that. It was the camera that was designed back in the 50s for the U-2 program, and the Air Force had declared it obsolete before our flight, so we were allowed to carry it on the flight.
Hmm.
And it took extremely good pictures. I could get a picture of something, down to about 4 feet, and I was at an altitude of 60 miles. So that, you know, pretty decent
That's,
camera.
That is amazing.
And then I carried a mapping camera, had a laser altimeter that recorded the altitude that the picture was taken above the surface. And it carried a whole series of remote sensing devices to scan the lunar surface. And the whole idea is that when the guys on the surface bring back the rocks, they analyze the rocks, they compare it with the remote sensing data. And, from all that information, you could build a program where you could just fly around the moon in orbit and pretty much figure out what the chemical composition of the lunar surface is everywhere.
And that really was one of the reasons then why NASA thought this was the most successful manned flight, right? Was what they were doing, but what you were doing as you were orbiting the moon, using all of these different instruments to measure various aspects of the moon's mm-hmm. surface and density. So you had the camera, Right. And then you had this, was it like a spectrometer or what was it?
Oh, we had all kinds of spectrometers. We had an X-ray, a microwave, a gamma ray. Let's see, what else did we have? We had three or four of them out there that we could point at the surface of the moon and remotely sense the lunar surface. And these things were all mounted on extendable poles from the service module. So I would run one of the spectrometers out on a pole to 25 or 30 feet to get it away from the spacecraft so there wasn't any interference. And that's pretty much what I did in lunar orbit. As a matter of fact, there was enough work to do that I was busy about 20 hours a day while I was there by myself recording all that stuff.
And some people call this the Wolverine mission. Is that right? Or something like that? Somebody emailed me that.
At one time or another, all three of us had gone to the University of Michigan.
Yeah.
Jim and I went to the graduate school there and got our master's degrees at Michigan. And I think Dave spent a semester there in undergraduate work before he went to MIT.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't undergrad. I guess it was graduate school, but he ended up going to MIT. And so he didn't get a degree from Michigan, but he got his degree from MIT.
Well, the only reason I say a friend of mine.
We've all been there at one time or another, so, you know, it was called the Wolverine, you know, it's kind of a Wolverine flight.
Yeah. A friend of mine who was a University of Michigan guy was really, like, over the moon, if you'll pardon the expression on that. So you did all of the things you were asked to do.
Yep.
And you come back and you enjoy a lot of the same celebration that the other astronauts have. You get the parades and the TV appearances and you met with the president, right?
Oh yeah. We went to the White House, took the kids to the White House. Met with President Nixon and Vice President Agnew at the time. We had a wonderful time there. In fact, I remember sitting out on the south portico of the White House overlooking the mall, talking to the president and the vice president, and President Nixon turned around to his butler and said, "Hey, you know, this is a special occasion. Go down and get, I forget what it was now, but it was a special kind of scotch that he had in his in his storeroom." And the butler says, "But Mr. President, there's really not much of it left. You've only got, you know, like part of a bottle left." He said, "I don't care. Go get it. We're all going to have a drink with that special scotch." He was really nice to us. Very, very friendly. I understand that the day before we got there, he was asking people who we were. But when we got there, he was very friendly. He particularly enjoyed giving all of our kids a tour of the White House and showing them the Lincoln Room and the Queen's Room and all that sort of thing. And he had particular fun showing them where all the bathrooms were in the hallways. They were all behind
like secret panels or?
Yeah, there were secret panels and you had to push in a certain place and the door would open and there'd be a bathroom in there. And he took great delight in showing the kids all of those things.
Oh, that's so
that was
funny.
Good. Then he sent us out to Camp David for the weekend with our kids. And that started several tours overseas that we made for him at the time, giving talks to, you know, heads of country and universities and all kinds of diplomats and, you know, places like Poland and England, and went to Yugoslavia and went to Italy and France, Germany, made quite a few stops on the trip.
And yet there was some tensions, if I remember, wasn't it right around that time, especially where, because of all the publicity, you started to run into a little bit more of a tension about who was going to say what on TV or how things were being perceived? Right? I thought that was really interesting because I don't.
Yeah.
Hang on to that thought. You know what? Because we're coming up on the top. And so we'll pick that up there, because I think that really does start to get into the story of when the wheels start to come off for Apollo 15 and what happens. And you go to coasttocoastam.com and you can see an image of what we're going to get to coming up. It seems like such a small, silly thing to essentially get fired over, but that's what happened with Al Warden and the other crew members of Apollo 15. We'll get to that coming up. Falling to Earth, the first time this story has been told. Believe me, when it comes to the training and all of the other, you know, really cool space stuff, there's so much more on that in the book and worth getting to. But I really want to talk about what happens and what happened to him personally as a result of NASA. And then also the insignia. Very interesting story behind the insignia for Apollo 15. We'll get to all that coming up. If you've missed any of the show, you can always go back and listen to it. If you're a Coast Insider, go to coasttocoastam.com and sign up there and get it anytime you want. Plus the Coast Zone newsletter too. And then we'll get to your questions for Al Warden coming up in about an hour on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet.